CliffCentral.com.
A little country for you this morning. Jason Aldean, The Lights Come On. It's on the Billboard 100 for this month. You like it? Yeah. Who don't like a little bit of country? All right, let's get into this. These guys from Joburg Today TV are here this morning, and they wanted to interview me, which occasionally happens, and I'm thrilled to talk about such stuff. So what do you guys want? Good morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
No, you got to sit in front of the microphone for us as well, remember.
Awesome.
Yeah, there we go. Is that right?
Yeah, that's great.
All right. What did you say your name was again? Riley?
Yes, Riley.
Okay, got you, Riley. See, awesome. I do pay attention. All right, Riley, what do you need to know, my friend?
Okay, so a whole lot of people actually don't understand that whether it be television or radio, whatever it is, especially mm-hmm. in media, there's quite a lot of preparation that goes into it prior to people going live. So mm-hmm. what does that look like for you?
What do you mean for this show? We kind of, you know, you think about things that are going on in the world, things that are going on in your life, and things that that everybody's talking about, and you bring them to the show in the morning. And I have never run out of, I've never looked at Ben and Mabali or Flax and Pashido or anyone else, or taken a call and gone, ugh, I really don't want to be here. There's always stuff to talk about, and it's not as much of an intensive, let's prepare this. This is what we're going to have to do. I mean, there's, you know, you need to know what guests are coming in. If they've got a book like Marco has that we're going to talk to just now, then you've got to read the book. Mm. But otherwise, if there's specific stuff we have to prepare around the show, it's usually done the day before. Mm. And Flax is producing, so he'll tell me, oh, we've got this guy popping in, or we've got this coming up on the show. And sometimes I'll say to him, I want to talk to this person, or we need to do this, but it's not like
rigid, it's, or clockwork.
It's not artificial. It's not manufactured. Is what I'm trying to say. It's not like we sit and we go, here's a list of things we're going to talk about today.
I guess that's also why people actually would tune in, because it's got that very kind of spontaneous, on the go type of feel of it.
I hope so.
Since you've been doing this for years, almost close to as long as I've been alive.
Actually. What are you talking about? Radio or this? Because we're only 2 years old. No,
radio and being yeah. within media. I mean, I'm sure you've met a whole lot of characters.
Are you sick of me yet?
No, not at all. I'm sure you've met a whole lot of characters, and you have to be versatile in terms of how to actually interact with them, in terms of like how they think and trying to get whatever you're trying to get out of them. So how essential is that versatility?
I don't even know what you just asked me. What do you mean?
To handle different characteristics, to handle different people.
You know what it is? It comes down to, I'm really interested in people. Like, I'm interested in them when they're in the studio with me. I don't really like them when I'm outside of the studio. But when they're in here, you could find out the most fascinating things about someone. And for that little bit of time that we spend together, I want to make it count. I want to make it valuable to whoever's listening, so that they listen and they go, I didn't know that. Or that's really a lot more, you know, controversial or complicated than I thought it might be. People explain themselves. They explain what they think about the world. They tell us how they got to those conclusions. It's more about them than it is about me when it comes to being versatile. I don't think about that. I've usually got an optimistic, funny outlook on life. So everything that happens in the studio from there on in is usually quite interesting. I don't overanalyze it.
Okay.
So don't you worry about doing that either. It makes me uncomfortable.
What do you think enables the DJ and the listeners to connect, and vice versa?
I don't know. Why don't we get someone to call in and tell you? Because I don't know the answer to that. You tell me what makes us connect. I think it's just that we share, you know, we wake up together. We start our day together. Mm. We talk about the stuff that's going on in the world. We talk about what we care about. Sometimes we get a little heated. Sometimes we argue. Sometimes we'll laugh together. And if you've been doing that for enough years with people who've listened to you for enough time, you feel like you really know each other. I mean, I feel like I know my audience, and I feel like they know me. Mm. That's what it boils down to.
And I'm sure you've actually had quite the awkward or probably even embarrassing moments. Does any one of them come to mind?
Every day is embarrassing. Didn't you hear me talking earlier about what I looked like in photographs? Every day there's something to talk about that's embarrassing. And I never leave here with a feeling of supreme self-confidence.
You always go out wearing
shades. Always humiliated,
yeah. Yeah, and just essentially, what keeps you motivated to perform at the level that you do every day that you do the show?
So sometimes I don't. Sometimes I don't feel like I'm performing at the level I'm meant to. We all get tired. Mm. You know, you're human. And if I came in here every day, bouncing off the walls and being all excited to be alive, which I try to do most of the time, and it doesn't even feel like an effort, but if I faked it, people would know straight away, A. And B, I would need some kind of chemical to keep me like that. And I, you know, I'm just like you. I'm not going to do that. Not for the sake of the job. I'd rather just be me. And if I'm grumpy some days, people probably stop listening. And if I'm on fire other days, they probably don't want to stop listening. I don't know, but I'd be thrilled if that were the case, that they wouldn't want to stop listening. I'd be delighted.
And I guess to some degree, there's...
You've got 2 minutes left, by the way.
Awesome. Yeah. Last question. And I guess there's some kind of like a responsibility of sorts when someone is behind the mic and actually broadcasting to millions or thousands of people.
Well,
what do you think?
Don't you think we all have that responsibility now in the age of social media? Everybody who's online could say or do or intimate something that could get them into huge amounts of trouble or could make them very, very popular and famous and interesting. So everyone has that power. It's not just people behind a microphone these days. You know, it's not only the people behind the cameras and the microphones that make the headlines. It could be anyone. There's probably someone sitting at home right now who's going to tweet something today and they'll regret it tonight.
That's
probably a lot of us who will. And that's the exciting thing about being around in 2016. It's exciting, but it's also terrifying because you don't know which of your opinions will be acceptable and which won't. And things change. What was acceptable 5 years ago to say online is probably not acceptable anymore in some ways.
Mm.
And those sands are always shifting, so you've got to keep your wits about you. And it's part of the exciting reason to want to engage with other people, to share ideas, to laugh together, to cry together, to feel things together. And every controversial story that comes up in the news is a possible area for you to argue, for you to agree, for lots of exciting things to happen.
Interesting.
Is that all you need?
That's all, folks.
Thank you, dude.
Thank you.
All right, Riley.
Awesome.
You and Joburg today.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
How do we find you? Just on YouTube?
We have our YouTube channel. Otherwise, you can hit us up on www.joburgtoday.tv.
Very good. Nice to have you here, man.
Thank you.
All right. Awesome. When we come back in a moment, it's going to be very exciting. We're going to speak to Marco Brocato. He's written a book called Rocks, One Man's Climb from Drugs to Dreams. And I've mentioned already the kind of ordeals that he went through as a kid, but you've got to hear what he's doing now, what he does for fun. He crossed the Saudi Arabian desert, Ben.
Wow.
Oh, yes. And I mean, that does not sound like the kind of place that you want to be stuck. So, in the next couple of seconds, we'll have Marco Brocato in with his book, Rocks.
1738. Telling you guys how I feel, man.
Right, Mr. Farquhar says, you gotta love that name, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Mr. Farquhar says on WeChat, for the guy who's interviewing you, here's the info you wanted. Tell him it is like a big group of friends sitting in a circle discussing the latest issues. We each get to chip in with me as the master of ceremonies, but that's pretty much what our show is like in the mornings. And thank you for that, Mr. Farquhar. All right, Fetty Wap with Wake Up. You got to wake up. It's Tuesday morning, just after 8 o'clock. Marco Brocato has written a book called Rocks. He's led an incredible life. I mentioned to Marco when I saw him outside just now that as I was reading this book on Sunday night, I kept looking at the clock because I was engrossed in the book, but I knew I had to eventually go to sleep. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to make it through Monday. And it was just... it was going from bad to worse, and then from worse to even more horrible, and from even more horrible to devastating. The kind of life that drugs led this guy to lead, it's unfathomable to someone like me who's never, you know, I know people who take drugs, I've seen them, I've never really been involved in it though, but the kinds of things that Marco got up to in order to keep sustaining his habit, and how the habit just led to relapses, and his poor family who had to put up with so much of his shit, it got me thinking about how many other people must be going through this kind of thing. And there must be lots of people who are. But your story is absolutely incredible. So Marco Brocato is here with us this morning. He is the author of the book Rocks. He's decided to write this book after what is a pretty amazing story, a pretty amazing life. And this morning he's here with us. Hey, Marco, nice to see you, man. Very, very good to have you here.
Morning, Gareth. Thanks for having me.
So as I mentioned, I picked up this book, and I've met you a couple of times before, and I know that you're a smart, successful entrepreneur now. You've got a great life. You've got a wife and two kids.
Three kids.
Three kids.
Yeah.
God, you're breeding like a machine.
Yeah.
Look at you. But this is not where it was. If you had to rewind the clock 15, 20 years,
it's a bad place.
Different man, huh?
Mm, completely. Yeah, I mean, it's... you know, often when people talk to me about this, I struggle to remember all the finer details. But I know that 20 years ago, if you had met me, you probably wouldn't have wanted to stay in the same room as me.
Well, you were in the underworld. I mean, you knew all the gangsters. You got into fights. You wrote off cars. You were high the whole time. You were stealing from your mom and dad. Your mother eventually was so exasperated, she just disowned you. She didn't know what to do.
Correct.
And you ended up in that No-Put Christian Care Center. Mm. But we're jumping the gun, because you didn't start off like that. You were like any other kid in Joburg, and you went to a nice school, and you had two sisters who you loved.
Yep.
And your dad and mom owned a family restaurant. They worked hard.
Yep.
So how did it start? How do you get into drugs?
So I think, I mean, you know, you hit something on the head there. I think that we often have this impression that drug addicts are naturally born, you know, as degenerates, and they're a product of this, of society or their surroundings. And I'm the perfect example to show that that's not the case. I grew up in a great family, a happy home. And, you know, I think with any kid, you have tendencies from a very young age. And for me, what I found was I was quite naughty from a very young age. And I always, you know, when given the chance to do something right or wrong, I would always do something wrong, you know. And it started for me with, particularly was lying. You know, lying for me was a big thing, you know. Like, I tell the most fantastical stories, you know. And, you know, initially as a kid, you get excused. Oh, he's just being a boy, and he's just, you know, he's got a great imagination, and that's amazing. But, like, it started to really calibrate my moral compass from a very young age. And what I mean by that is that I'm really a big proponent of this choice thing, you know, that, you know, you ultimately are going to make decisions in your life, but becoming an addict is not a black and white. You know, there's a gray area, and you grow into it. So for me, and the reason why I'm saying this is that even from a young age, I would generally always err on the side of naughtiness. So I suppose as my life progressed, and as my sort of my career at school progressed, you know, the natural thing for me was to want to be accepted by people around me. And the guys that were generally popular then were the naughty guys in the class, you know, the guys that were smoking and drinking. So, I mean, for me, it was just a fait accompli. I had to do it. But what is quite strange is I had this innate sense that I never wanted to become a drug addict. I mean, we had a talk at school. I remember, you know, the cops came in primary school, and they told us about drugs and all these weird stories.
Drugs are bad, okay.
Yeah, and I was like, hey, you know, who wants to become a drug addict? It sounds so crazy, you know. And I really honestly thought that I never would become a drug addict in my life.
Yeah.
You know, fast forward like 3 years, and it was a very different story. But I think what I'm trying to say is that even though I had this really strong sense that I didn't want to go to drugs, I'd already made those choices a long time ago. You know, I made bad choices after bad choice after bad choice.
Now, your sister was already using, and you kind of looked up to her.
Correct.
Which is also part of the thing. And you mixed with a couple of friends. You had this one mate called Dwayne.
Yeah.
Who was also, he started using some stuff. But you don't start with the hardcore stuff, right?
Yeah, you start smoking weed.
Yeah, a little bit of weed, and maybe you do some MDMA at a party or whatever.
Yeah, that's it. MDMA, so ecstasy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, it always starts like that, and in the book I say that's the fun side of drugs, right?
Yeah.
Because everything's amazing, everyone's having fun, it's a good time. You're generally happy when you're taking the stuff, but what slowly starts to happen is that those highs that you had in the beginning really aren't the same ever again. You know, that first MDMA rush is never the same.
You can
as
never
it was.
Get back to it.
Never. Never ever. So you're constantly chasing that, you know, and so the natural progression is you'll take more and more and more, or you'll take something that's stronger, you know, and for me, that happened quite quickly. So I suppose
You started at what, 70?
No, so 60. At 15.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. So I started using cocaine at 15.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But I mean, I was also quite unique in the sense that I took my first ecstasy tablet and my first line of cocaine together at 15. So, I mean.
Unique.
Yeah. Well, what I mean to say is.
It's a hell of an intro.
Yeah, I just started quite quickly. But I think that, you know, it just for me, ecstasy wasn't really good enough anymore because I just wasn't getting the fun out of it that I used to get. And obviously, you need to support this habit. You know, so you start off taking drugs as a social thing, right? But before you know it, you get like ingrained in this lifestyle because the only way you're going to fund it is by, you know, doing stuff that you really shouldn't be doing, apart from taking drugs, of course.
Now, you go into a couple of stories here, and I don't want this to turn into like a lecture about drugs because I know that that's not what you would want either. There's nothing worse than someone saying, you know, I've been through this and it's hell and you shouldn't either and preaching. But the fact is, like the stories that got me so into the book, like your one mate went with you to a club one night and you guys were taking stuff and it was his first time taking stuff. You went home with him because he was staying at your house. He told his parents he's going to stay at your house, you know, your mates. And he went to sleep on like a sleeping bag or a mattress next to your bed and you went to sleep and you had to take some sleeping pills because at that stage you were so buzzing that you couldn't get to sleep. And explain what happened.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is an ordinary guy like me, came from a great family, and, you know, we'd been using, and he had taken, that night, we sort of didn't have a lot of money. So, you know, we went out to a pool hall, and we had actually taken, you know, the $50 that we had, and we bought one rock, and I thought that was going to go very far, and it never goes far. And obviously, I think I was a bit more of a maniac than he was, and I was saying to him, well, listen, we need to do more stuff, you know, because we can't just stop here. I mean, this is actually crazy. So we went and we bought some heroin, and I didn't know that he had never taken heroin before, but, you know, he said that he had did, and anyway, we took some heroin, and we went home that night, lay on the bed, you know, before we had gotten home, he'd actually passed out at the club that we were at. I found him lying on the floor. I took him to the hospital. And
he begged you to not leave him in the hospital, right?
Yeah, correct. Because he didn't want, I mean, obviously.
He didn't want his parents to find out.
Correct. So, and look, they didn't want to discharge him, but they said he was fine. So anyway, we went home, got into bed. I told my mom, listen, you know, wake him up. He's got to go to work tomorrow morning early. I didn't have to work that Saturday. And anyway, I went to sleep that night. I took the sleeping tablets because I needed to go. I needed to crash because I was just so out of it. And anyway, that morning, I remember hearing the door open. My mom came into the room and trying to call. His name was Gwayne. She was trying to get him awake.
Yeah.
And I just knew inherently what had gone wrong. I knew that was it, that he was gone. And that's really
what... He died.
He died next to me while we were sleeping. And yeah, so, I mean, he'd obviously overdosed after the fact, which is quite strange, but yeah, he literally died next to me in my room, and obviously that traumatized my mother to no end. I mean, all of us. For me, my what's crazy though is my main concern in that moment wasn't necessarily about the fact that he had gone. It was, oh my gosh, the cops are going to come and I've got heroin in my room. You know, that was my first sort of biggest fear. And obviously, looking back on that, I'm ashamed of that. But, you know, to be honest, that was my first emotion was, oh gosh, the cops are going to be here and now what?
So did you try and get rid of it or what happened?
Yeah, I hid it in a drawer, but the cops still found it. They weren't supposed to because they had no reason to search my room. But
you were so good at lying at this point that you just told them it was his.
Correct. Yeah. I just said, look, I'm not sure what this is. You know, obviously it must be his. And yeah, that's how it ended.
And you would take jobs. I mean, I'm skipping around a bit here because your story, I don't want people to not buy the book. Mm-hmm. Go and get the book. It's really worth reading. And I would encourage anybody who, you know, wants to know how things worked in that whole scene. Because you talk about how the dealers work and how each dealer has, well, they're runners, then they're dealers, and then the dealers all have distributors, and the distributors have a boss.
Yeah.
And if you can get up to the bus, you can become a dealer or a distributor. Mm. And you can make enough money to pay for your own habit and make some cash on the side.
It's a very well-run, very well-thought-out operation.
Yeah, I mean, it's a business. Yeah. It's a proper business. Guys are making a killing. But yeah, I mean, I think that's when you get involved in that side of it, though, you start to see the underbelly. And I say this in the book as well, is that, you know, it stops from being fun to being quite serious. You know, you start seeing things that...
Well, you're mixing with people who don't have a problem killing or beating up some teenage girl or doing whatever they have to extract money from someone else.
Yeah.
But let's just go back, because money is an important part of this. I mean, your family weren't supremely wealthy, and you were costing them a fortune because maybe they were in denial. You acknowledge in the book, maybe your parents knew already, but they didn't say anything. You eventually had to open up to your mom after the umpteenth time that you were in hospital because you'd ridden off a car or, you know, you'd had an epileptic fit because you developed those.
Yeah.
You probably always had a predisposition to them, but you developed them as a result of your addictions. But one of the things that I found pretty disturbing is you went and you got a job at a jewelry store, and you needed money to fund your drug addiction, so you started doing some dodgy stuff.
Yeah, I started to steal.
You stole from the safe, right?
Yeah, I stole. I mean, that was the main thing. I mean, I would really steal whatever was lying around anywhere. But
you started at home. You would
correct.
You'd steal the TV.
I mean, that's the net.
Say there was someone broke in. Or
yeah, and then money out of the purses. My mom was so scared at some points. I mean, she got so worried, eventually she'd take her purse with her to the bathroom. You know, I mean, that's how bad things were, and lock her room at night. But anyway, in the jewelry store, I mean, I stole a ring of substantial value.
It's like a 300,000 rand ring.
Yeah, correct. I thought I'd hit the jackpot. Anyway, you see the resale price of these things, and you try to sell them on the black market and never really realizes the value that
you
wanted.
Who bought it from you?
It was another dealer, in fact, a distributor in Hillbrow. They bought it. He subsequently passed away. But
how much did you get for a 300,000 rand ring?
10,000 rand.
Sure.
Yeah, 10,000 rand. But anyway, that's not the crazy part. So after that, you know, obviously the store had realized what had happened, that there was theft that had gone on, and I got called in along with the rest of the staff to say, listen, there's been some theft going on, and this was quite a serious store. So they brought in these forensic auditors to come in, and one of these guys was a polygraph expert, and they said, well, nobody's going anywhere, we're shutting the store down. It was a Saturday in Sandton City. Everyone's going to go have an interview, and basically we're going to figure out who's been stealing. So, I mean, you know, it's at that point that your heart drops and you realize, gosh, I've been caught. And anyway, everyone went for their polygraphs and so did I. At the end of mine, the guy that looked at me and said, look, I know you definitely didn't steal the ring, but you probably have a suspicion on who did steal the ring, you know. And in fact, there was what had happened also, there was a whole lot of theft that was going on outside of, like, without me even knowing. But yeah, I mean, I managed to fool them and fool the polygraph essentially and come out of it on top, which is quite unnerving actually, because, you know, I suppose I became so good at lying. I mean, there was points in my life where I don't even remember if I ever told the truth. And the thing is, you start to believe the lies, you know, and you actually start to convince yourself that these fake realities are real. Yeah, it's crazy.
But then does it become a matter of keeping track of the last lie you told so that you don't get caught?
Yeah, you have to be good at it. I mean, you have to understand, but sometimes also you forget. I realized that there was degrees of lying as well. I mean, I would lie about lies that I'd lied about. You know, and then it runs away with you because then you can't remember
but
anything.
But you have to be so smart to be able to tangle yourself up in that kind of web of lies. You can't be doff. In other words, you must, I mean, I know you're an intelligent guy and now you're applying yourself in useful ways, but it's amazing how that intelligence can be turned into nefarious things.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, what you're capable of doing is horrendous if you really put your mind to it. But eventually it does start to unravel. I mean, the wheels come off.
Well, we'll get into some of the stories about how that happened, but the lying is what was the real problem, because the addictions were just, you know, I mean, they've done these experiments on mice and things, and they say that if you have something to live for, and if your life is full and meaningful, and you've got relationships that matter and that kind of thing, that you're less likely to become addicted, no matter what, you know, all substances are either, they're all neutral, or in some way they're interesting to you, but to get addicted, you have to actually have some kind of deficit in your life. And obviously the fact that you were a pathological liar at this point was way more of a problem than that you were addicted to stuff.
Yeah.
Because that, the one is chemical, and you could sort that out in some ways. And the other one is something that you have to figure out psychologically.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough because, I mean, and that's how I ended up in a place called Sterkfontein after a while. I mean, this is my...
That's the mental hospital.
Yeah, correct. And I was in a lockup ward as well.
He walks in. Just describe what you saw the one guy doing at the window when you walked in.
Yeah, so I walked in. So I went to Sterkfontein, maybe just to give you some context. I went there after my third suicide attempt. You know, basically I got sectioned there by the courts. They said I was a danger to myself and a danger to society. So they committed me to Sterkfontein. And I remember walking in there. The first thing I did was my mom took me there. And essentially I was a ward of the state now. But my parents and family had taken me there to basically check me in. And I remember turning around and looking at my mom after all the trouble and pain I'd caused her and said to her, you know, you did this to me. Because I could see she was fearful. I mean, this place looks hectic. You know, even after everything I did, I still blamed her for it. And she broke down into tears. And then they took me through into this passage and down into the ward. And there was a guy at the window, and he was eating the window putty. That was his thing, right? I mean, he used to eat window putty.
Mad.
But then we walked into the rec room or the common room, and you know, everyone was watching TV, but they were fighting and arguing about what to watch, but the TV was broken, you know. And I remember thinking to myself, this is insane. I mean, like, I'm not crazy. I mean, these guys are crazy.
Mm.
You know, 3 weeks later, I was arguing about the same TV that didn't work, you know. And I think that's a product of the medication they put you on there just to keep you, like, chilled out.
That medication, does it numb you, or is that in itself another kind of high?
I started dealing it in Sterkfontein. I'd get all the guys to collect the medicine and pretend they'd taken it and give it to me, and I started like a little business in there selling the pills. So you can definitely get high on it. A lot of it's tranquilizers, so there's no uppers, but some of the stuff just is there to kill you. I mean, when I say kill you, I mean to numb you. I mean to the point where you can't do anything.
You don't feel highs and lows
correct.
At all.
You
right?
just duck a zombie.
It's interesting, even in the mental hospital, you became a dealer.
Yeah.
And you were trying to convince the student who was there to evaluate you that it was time for you to get out.
Mm.
You were manipulating everything.
Yeah, and that's the problem. And you said this earlier, you know, for me, lying was a massive issue. And it's something that, you know, I dealt with from a very young age. And the drugs were just the sort of the way I acted it out, you know, in terms of doing something.
It could have been gambling. It could have been sex. It could have been anything.
And, how do you stop that? So, I mean, when you're born to manipulate, when I say when you're born to it, when you've programmed yourself to manipulate people, it's very difficult not to manipulate people. So I got it right there as well. I mean, the psychiatrist, it was more tough in Sterkfontein because every Monday morning they have what they call a ward round where you meet with all the psychiatrists and then you need to tell them why you think you're better, you know, and it is quite difficult because everyone is trying to convince them that they're not crazy, you know. So, you know, that was tough, but I knew that there was an easy way in because there was a young student who was an intern essentially there and she was studying, and I played on her good nature, and eventually I got her to think that I was okay, you know, just through my manipulation, and I got released eventually after a while. But that was my life. I would just manipulate wherever I could.
Tell me about what happened, first of all, on this game farm when you went there with your friend Dwayne, and then later on when you went there because your parents just wanted you out of town where all the bad influences were.
So the first time I went, when I went there with Dwayne, we thought it would be a good idea to take acid in the bush. Like most people do. When I say most people, I mean crazy people. So we went to the bush, we took some acid, we double dropped and took two acid caps each of these double dip fat cats.
What does it feel like to be on acid?
It's surreal. I mean, everything's just weird. I mean, like it's just nothing's the same. It's just a strange sensation. Your senses are enhanced. You see things, hear things, and, you know, everything's going on. It's almost like another world's opened up to you, right? But what was crazy in this moment is that we had taken the stuff out in the middle of the bush in Big Five territory with no, like, we had no sense of what we were going to do. We just thought it would be really a cool thing to do. And things just started to unravel that night. I mean, we started to, you know, have these weird psychotic breaks, and we thought that, you know, the whole world was coming to an end, and our fire was dying, literally, like the fire. And we knew that if the fire died, we would die. So we started to come up with these weird solutions on how we were going to fix it. We burnt our clothes. So that's strange enough on its own. So then we were naked in the bush without clothes on, trying to figure out how we're going to keep the fire going. Then we decided we were going to set fire to the whole bush just to keep the fire going. And thank goodness that never happened. And right at the end, we were quite depressed. And then I said to him, listen, it's over. We can't carry on anymore. Let's end this now. And I took my dad's firearm out the car. He had a 7.62 millimeter Beretta. And I said to him, look, we can't live anymore. And this is just to give you an indication
because
of the depravity.
Because you're so high, you're correct. Out of it. You're not on this plane.
Correct. So I took the gun, cocked it, put it in my mouth, and I said to him, cheers. And we filmed this entire event, you know, because we wanted people to see what we'd been through. And I pulled the trigger, you know, with a gun in my mouth, and it never went off. It misfired.
And it was loaded. There were bullets in the chamber, correct. In the magazine. Yeah, it just didn't fire.
Yeah.
By a ball hair, you're still here.
Correct. And then he saw me do that, and then he said, well, he also wants to do that. You know, he said, no, well, he also wants to give it a shot. I mean, this is how crazy it is, right? And this is the thing. You never do stuff like this thinking it's going to end up there, but it does so quickly. Before you even realize it, you're dead. And he took the gun, and as he was about to do it himself, thank goodness the phone rang. It was his girlfriend, and then sort of the moment was lost. We just forgot about it.
You get very easily distracted,
correct. It was,
I suppose,
done. You know,
yeah.
We forgot about the gun, went away, and we carried on with the evening. And that was the first time. And then the next time I went there, it was sort of during this difficult phase of my life. You know, things had come apart. I'd been caught. Obviously, people knew that I was using. I'd been caught stealing, and I was just in a bad space. And just after, in fact, it was just after Sterkfontein. I'd always been passionate about the bush and nature and conservation. So my parents said, I said to them, let me go do a course. And I went and I did this game ranger course, which didn't really last long. The course I finished, but I got a job at a game reserve called Pinda, but then that didn't last long because I was actually using it and trying to steal from all the guys that I was on the course with. So eventually I said to my parents, look, just send me to the farm where I'd been and I'll go and work and help out there. And sort of that was my second stint there. And I really went away from Joburg just so that I could stay clean. But, you know, I would be great for 2-3 weeks, and then, you know, this pool would just come back, and I'd find my way back to Joburg and then relapse hectically. I'd binge for, you know, a week and just destroy everything again until I'd try to kill myself again.
And you actually thought about killing your parents once.
Yeah, so that was sort of probably about a week before everything really came to a head. I was lying in bed, and I still had that firearm, that same firearm that I tried to kill myself with the first time, because my dad had given it to me to keep in the bush while I was living there. And I basically thought to myself, well, I'm going to murder my parents. And I had this whole plan. You know, I would go and kill them in their bed while they were sleeping, and I'd pretend that this was a housebreak or a robbery. I knew we had been through a robbery, and I just thought, well, it's easy to explain. And in my mind, there was this inheritance that was waiting for me. You know, meanwhile, I'd basically wiped them out anyway. But, I mean, that's how far it got, and I'd planned this whole thing, and yeah, by God's grace, I never got to that point because it all came apart a week later, and I ended up going to rehab. But, I mean, that's how close it was. And, in fact, statistically, parricide, which is children killing parents, is on the rise. I mean, there's more parents that are killed by children today than there've ever been.
And do you reckon a lot of it is because of drugs?
Yeah, so I would say at least 70% of it is drug-related or psychologically related. But, I mean, you know, we hear it all the time. You know, these kids go in and do horrendous things, and it's just for money. It's for money, for drugs.
It's just, I mean, reading this story, I thought the whole way through, it can't get any worse. You drove your sister's car out of a parking lot in Rosebank after you were partying at a club, and you had a fit because you also, like, you were buzzing off the charts. And you drove into, like, about 4 or 5 other cars. You drove into some person while they were getting out of their car. And then you somehow managed to just get out of there, and like you escaped again.
Yeah. Yeah, so the amount of times I escaped death is astounding.
Tell us about some of those.
So, I mean, I've had some serious car accidents where I should have died, but I didn't, you know. And that was one occasion where I literally drove over. At the end, I landed on top of a polo player. I mean, my car was on top of a polo player. And, you know, there was other times where I tried to kill myself, you know, so I set my wrists, you know, to the point where my heart had stopped beating, and they had to resuscitate me. I've been stabbed, just outside of Rosebank as well, also bled out, was resuscitated on the side of the road. I took an overdose of sleeping tablets, and then also I tried to shoot myself, you know, so, I mean, in that time it worked, you know, except I didn't try to kill myself, but I tried to shoot myself in the arm so that I could pretend I'd been hijacked. Because I just sold one of the phones that my parents had given me or my sister had given me, and I didn't want to be caught out again. But the bullet did travel through my arm and went into my back. But, I mean, I came through it. But I'm a lucky one, you know, because a lot of guys don't. That's why I feel that there's a massive purpose behind why I'm still here, is that I've got to tell people that, you know, there's hope.
Now, your parents, through all of this, I mean, the fact that they even cared at the end, I mean, they must have just been so desperate to be rid of you. Because you did everything you could to make their lives a nightmare. Mm. You told absolute bullshit stories about your dad, that he was abusive and that he'd always hated you. And I mean, you made things up. Mm. This is part of the manipulation.
Yeah.
You almost caused your parents to get divorced. Your poor mother must have been a basket case by the end of this.
She was.
I mean, how do you even come back from that?
So my mom also tried to commit suicide because of what I put her through. So she tried to take her own life as well, just because she couldn't take it anymore. And it's rough. I mean, you know, when I think back today and I look at what I did to my family, it's deplorable. I mean, it's no parent should ever have to go through that, especially from their children. And you love your children. I mean, I've got three of my own kids.
Do you feel incredible guilt whenever you think about this stuff?
I do. I mean, it's something that I'll have to live with for the rest of my life. And I've tried my best wherever I can to make amends. And I'm hoping that I'm the son now that they've always wanted. And I've tried to really just show the world that, you know, I mean, I had great parents. My dad was an amazing human being, and he is today. He's an amazing person. He's the most gentle, kind-hearted person I've ever met. Even after everything I did to them, my dad still took me to the bus to go to rehab, you know, which really broke my heart because I'd put him through hell. But that's the thing, is that we as addicts thrive on division. You know, the minute that there's, you can create arguments in the house and people like on polar opposite sides of the fence, you're going to succeed because then you sort of wangle your way through the middle. But, you know, my mother at the end was done with me. I mean, you know, my last car accident, you know, I was lying in hospital and normally, I mean, I knew how this worked. I was in hospital, she'd come, she'd cry, oh, I'm glad you're right, whatever the case is. But that night I had a car accident again in Rosebank and my mother walked into the trauma unit at the Linksworth Hospital and I was lying there and she just came up to me and she gave me a hiding while I was lying on the hospital bed. And then she said to me, you know, I wish you would just die. She said to me, I actually wish you would die. That's what I'm praying for. I pray that you would die now. Because you don't want to die. Like, I wouldn't die. Like, I never died. And she said, I'm done. Like, I wish you would die so I could bury you. And that I could forget about all these problems and that you wouldn't hurt yourself and anyone else anymore. And then that was it. My mom said to me, you're dead to me. I don't want to know you anymore. I mean, this was after I had a bit of a tirade with her and said to her, what do you know? You don't know what I've been going through. And then she said to me, look, I'm done. And she left. And that was it. You know, and the next day.
She even went with you once into Hillbrow.
Yeah, she didn't go willingly.
Something.
Correct. No, I took her. So what happened was, I was using that day, and we went out for dinner at my sister's house. And at this point, only my mom knew about my addiction, and I was hanging badly. And I said to her, listen, mom, you know, I need some money to get drugs, and she broke down into tears saying, no, I can't give you money. And I was like, well, if you don't give me money, I'm going to steal everything from my sister's house and then they'll know that your son is a rubbish. That's what I told her. You know, just this emotional blackmail. And she was just in tears. And then eventually she said to me, fine, I'll give you some money. So I took her with me to the ATM. She got into the car, got the money, and then I drove, and I was driving straight to Hillbrow. I mean, she's an old lady, and she didn't want to go to Hillbrow, but I was on a mission. We were on the M1. My mother tried to jump out the car while I was driving. She was like, just like completely like, you know, panicked, and she was trying to literally get out the car while I was doing 100 kilometers an hour in the hour. And I remember saying to her, like, stop behaving like a child. You know, you're such a child. Anyway, we got into Hillbrow, and I left in the car. I just left her there, and I went up to the merchant, spent some time smoking rocks, forgot about my mom, literally. Thank goodness she was still there when I got back to the car. But that's what I did, yeah.
So what is the difference between when you are completely high out of your mind and when you are desperately looking to get high? Because it sounds to me like in both states, you know, your logic and your thinking is compromised to some degree. So what's the difference between the two?
I think that your logic is driven by the need to want to take drugs, right? And when I say the need, it's not something that you can't ever fight. It's just that you don't want to fight it. So I think that, you know, the difference when you're out of it, you know, you are more likely to make stupid decisions. Like when you're drunk, you know, you can do things, you can make choices that aren't really good for you.
Yeah.
But you know, when you're hanging, you're a far more dangerous individual. And I say that because I would literally do whatever it took to get drugs. So when I was in between highs and I needed
like
to get...
For example, you went downstairs once when your parents had people there at their house. You took the credit cards and the cash out of all of your mother and father's friends' bags and pockets.
And phones.
And their phones. And you went off and...
And I just left
pawned
them.
It.
Yeah, I pawned it. So you'd do anything.
Can you imagine your parents having to explain that?
Yeah, they lost those friends. They never were. They were their best friends. And yeah, but I was ready to kill. I mean, for drugs. If you had offered me at my worst money to, you know, kill someone, I would have done it.
And you mentioned in the book, like, for a lot of girls, it would lead to prostitution. Mm. I mean, these are girls from perfectly nice families, you know. I'm not saying necessarily wealthy families, but, you know, good people.
Yeah.
They might not have a whole lot of money. The mom might be a teacher or a nurse or she could even be a domestic worker, but the daughter is just so desperate to get high that she'll sell her body.
Yeah, and it happens all the time. I mean, I've had cases where, you know, mothers have pawned their babies with the Nigerian drug dealers just so that they can get rocks and then tell them that they'll go draw the money and bring back the money to get the baby. I mean, anyone in their right mind thinks, well, they'll come back.
Sure, they'll come back for a baby.
And they never do. You know, they never come back. You know, so you will do whatever it takes to get drugs. And it's not just the women that turn to prostitution, it's men as well. Yeah. You know, so, I mean, that's the easiest way to get money, you know, apart from stealing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you'll get to the point where you have no self-worth and you'll do whatever it takes.
Is that why a lot of pimps will get people hooked on drugs deliberately, because they know then it'll be easier for them to just sell their bodies every time?
Normally it starts the other way around. So normally you are addicted and you'll go to a drug dealer and then they'll say, okay, well, listen, instead of you paying me for it, I'm going to use your services and unsell you, essentially. So they keep you at the point where you're in need of the stuff so that you keep working.
And Marco, you dealt for a while too, so you knew all the networks and the hierarchies, and you know, you made some good money, and then you started using more than you were bringing in.
Yeah. So I wasn't.
Then you get into trouble.
Correct. I mean, I'd come back after a long weekend and realize that I had to cash up with some really bad people, and had no money, you know, and no drugs left. And that's a scary place to be. You get to realize that your life it doesn't really mean much to anyone else. And again, I put my parents in the firing line literally for that. I mean, I had people come into my house with guns, you know, looking for me. I had a hit out on me. I would rob anyone. I mean, I got to the point where I was robbing the big guys. You know, I would take their stock and then I would just, you know, use it or sell it and then go buy rocks. And it was crazy. I robbed the Nigerian drug dealers in Hillbrow. I got to the point where I was...
You were so ballsy.
Yeah.
You robbed the Nigerian drug leaders.
Yeah. A couple of times. I'd break into their houses. I'd steal their stuff and then I'd rob them. Yeah. So... And then you literally, you're playing with your life. I mean, because right at the end of my addiction, everyone was looking for me, literally. I mean, the fact that I didn't get killed before that was a major miracle. But, yeah, I mean,
Did you feel indestructible at a certain point?
I just felt like nothing I ever did actually worked. You know, like, I wasn't dying, but, you know, like... I just, you know, I honestly hated the person I'd become. I really was like the walking dead. I walked around, I hated everything about my life. I hated the fact that I needed to get up every morning and try and figure out how I was going to get drugs. And I think that fueled this completely reckless attitude of mine. It was like, I just didn't care anymore. I was destructive. I was in like self-destruct mode and nothing or no one could take me out of it until, you know, right at the end when, you know, I finally, like, my senses came back to me, you know, and...
Now, tell me about this Nopwerk Christian Care Center, because that's where you eventually went.
Yeah.
And this place is in the middle of nowhere. It's in the desert. Nobody wants to be in the middle of nowhere. It's very strict. It runs on a sort of strict Christian ethos. It's picked up over the years a couple of controversial stories in terms of the way that it treats its patients. There have been people who've died while they've been in what would you call it, treatment there. And you were there while some of those controversial things happened.
Yeah.
What kind of a place is this Nopwerk Christian Care Center?
So maybe let me start that. I thought when I went to Nopwerk, I imagined these beautiful white picket fences and beautiful trees. And you know, I was a spoiled kid, so I thought that's where I'm going. You know, and when I got there, it was a shock to the system. It was a dusty old town in the middle of nowhere with one tar road that is only about 400 meters long. And just this overwhelming sense that you're in the middle of nowhere. And I got there and, you know, the first thing that strikes you, I mean, I went to Nopwerk. I wasn't religious in any way. I didn't really have any faith or anything.
You've been raised Catholic though, right?
Yeah, I was raised Catholic, but, you know, very luck. I mean, my parents told us, listen, you go to church because we're Italian and that's how it is. But you don't have to believe in, you can believe in whatever you want to believe in.
Right.
And... Anyway, I got to Nopwerk, and Nopwerk is a tough rehab, I've got to be honest with you, but it's also what they call a self-help program. So the program is not hands-on in the sense that it's not a psychological program. You're not going to have counselors and psychologists and psychiatrists. You get there, And pretty much that's the last stop for a lot of addicts. You know, that is the place that you're going to go to if every other place has failed. And I've been to many other rehabs before that. But I think, you know, what struck me about NoPut, and also, you know, there's a lot of bad press. Let me put it this way. There's no perfect rehab in the country.
No, you're dealing with very, very damaged people, often.
Correct. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the thing, is that we forget. You know, NoPut is a step away from jail for a lot of people.
Or death.
Or death. So the people that get there are really, you know, miserable people to start with. But, you know, in my experience, the NoPut was great for me. It was just what I needed. It helped me understand that I needed to change and make the right choices. But, you know, a lot of the negative stuff that happened there, I can honestly say that, you know, there was nothing untoward. Do they make mistakes in NoPut? Yes. I'm not involved in
it. It's not like they were putting people into animal cages and throwing water on them at 3 a.m. or any of that stuff.
No. So what we did do, and what we were put through, like when we were on punishment, there's a program called corrective intervention, where, you know, you literally do military style PT from 3 o'clock in the morning onwards. You know, but to get there, you have to have broken the rules. I mean, it's not like you just do that. It's not everyone does that. In my case, it was because I wrote. Then a girl on the program, a poem, which I wasn't allowed to, who then later became my wife. So it all turned out for
was
the best.
She was just working there or something, wasn't she? Yeah, what was the story?
She got there, she'd been smoking a bit of weed, and she was messing around out in George, and her mom was working there. So when she came there, they said, you can stay and do your schooling here, but you have to do one program, which she did. And that's where sort of I met her. And then she stayed on and worked in the school. She was a teacher. She was helping teach the kids, and that's sort of how we nurtured our relationship. We actually got married in NoPut, if you can
believe
it.
But you weren't allowed to have relationships when you arrived, right?
No, we weren't. We weren't allowed to, yeah.
So you got punished because you sent her a love letter.
Yeah, and this was actually what I used to do.
She bust you.
She did, yeah, my wife. My wife bust me. And I still thought to myself, how's this chick? You know, it's crazy. But anyway, it turned out for the best, and she's honestly one of the best things that's ever happened to me in my life.
Sure. Do you think she was also instrumental in you kicking these habits?
I think it can go one of two ways, right? So I think if you get involved as an addict with another addict, it's a recipe for disaster. But at the same time, it can also be a good thing. So for us, we both had our heads screwed on right. I mean, we made right choices and we realized we never wanted to go back to that lifestyle. So she's been a massive support to me.
How did you know? Because you kind of breezed through the NoPut stuff in your book. Not to say that you don't go into some detail, but you certainly don't say, this was the moment where I turned the corner. Is there such a moment, or is it a progressive thing?
So there's probably been about three of those moments in my life where I've realized, you know, listen, you know, things need to change, and I felt like I was on the right track. The first was when just before I went to NoPut, after my mom had said what she'd said to me, and my family said to me, listen, we're sending you to NoPut, but understand one thing, whether you go there, whether you get on the bus, you leave, or you run away, or even if you complete the program, you're dead to us. So they said, we're not sending you to NoPut so you can come clean. We're sending you to NoPut so that when you die, we've done everything in our power to help you. This is for us. So that was the first realization and wake up call. And I started to think, well, I need to change. I've lost everyone now. And that was the first point. The second one was in NoPut, where, you know, NoPut's a Christian program. And, you know, it was there where for me as a believer, I didn't know then, I gave my heart to the Lord and I became born again, you know. And that was the second moment. And I realized that choice is a big thing. And that if I could be forgiven for all of the horrible things that I'd done, not by people, but by God, then I was in a good place. So that was my redeeming moment in life, was my salvation. And then the third aspect was after I left NoPut. I got myself into some dangerous situations. Even though I'd been clean almost 3 years, but I started doing door-to-door sales and selling these power-saving units, which were actually a big scam. I didn't know it. And we used to go out on these field trips. Now, I'd just come out of NoPut. I'd been recently married. And I was with all these kids again, you know, like on a business trip, you know. So can you just imagine what was going on? Were drinking, carrying on. And I came really, really close to losing everything again. And one night, you know, just after I made a couple of bad choices, you know, I sat there and I'd lied to Catherine. And I said to
your
myself,
wife.
Yeah, to my wife. And I was thinking to myself, oh my gosh, I'm going back. I've been clean 3 years now and it's all over. And then, you know, like the next day, I was dealing and grappling with this thing. My wife was stressed. She thought, that's it. I've married this person that everyone warned me about. And I just had this sense that it was different now. Like, I really, I can't explain it, but I had this, like, inner sense from God, or, you know, that things were going to be different, that I didn't have to go back to where I was, that I could, in this moment, decide to change my life. And that, for me, was probably the biggest moment, was that I realized that was it. And that's when I started to really understand that addiction's a choice, it's not a disease, you know, that I could decide in that moment that, you know what, just because that's what I used to do, doesn't mean I have to do it anymore. And it was that, from that moment onwards, that I really grew as fast as I did, and my life changed.
How taxing are the relapses? Because I think a lot of people just assume, oh, well, if I send my child to a rehab for 6 months and they come out, and everything will be back to normal again, and I'll never have to worry about them. But the fact of the matter is, you fall off that wagon often, don't you?
Yeah, you do. And I mean, the thing is this, and I say this right at the end of the book, is that if you're an addict and you've failed, don't stop trying. The reality is this, is that, you know, you need to be mindful of where you've come from. You need to understand that the systems that you operate in within this world are going to make life extremely difficult for you. And relapses are, I wouldn't say they're inevitable, because some people manage to get through it. But there's a chance, a very high chance, that you are going to. And the choice there is, what do you do once you've relapsed? You can either go back to your original state and let, the wheels have come off, it's over now. Or you can get back up. And that's the key, is to get back up as fast as you can, you know, and just get on with it. And parents need to, and family members need to support their family by having, you know, a rigid set of rules and consequences in place if that moment should ever come.
The first time I met you, I didn't know any of this, and we were at lunch with a mutual friend, and you told me about this trip that you've taken over the Arabian Peninsula. Mubs, this is through a part of the Arabian desert where nobody lives. It's called the Empty Quarter, right? There's nothing there. It's just sand. And I'm fast forwarding because we're almost at 9 o'clock, and there was so much I wanted to talk to you about that comes after, you know, rehab and everything. But this is probably one of the most desolate places in the universe. There's no water, there are no animals, there are no people, there's nothing. There's sand as far as you can see in every direction.
Yeah.
What kind of madness is this? Why would you go there?
Well, I mean, if you've almost been dead, does that seem like the worst thing in the world, going there?
So, I mean, I started getting passionate about showing people that even me, you know, this degenerate, could do something with their lives, you know, and it was really just to show people that you can put your mind to the seemingly impossible and
How did you guys make it across the desert? I mean, you can't carry that much water.
Yeah, it was tough. So we did. So we set a world record. We were the first team to cross the Empty Quarter unsupported and on foot. And what that means is we pulled our own water for the entire journey, although the rules did allow for us to stop at natural oases to fill up. So there were 3 oases along the journey. So we had to carry, at the heaviest, 580 kilograms of water in a cart that we'd made with wheels. And we pulled it. It was 52-degree heat. We pulled about 38 kilometers a day through the sand.
The sun must have burnt you to a crisp.
Yeah, it did. It burnt us. I think it burnt my mind. I think I'm more affected now as well. But it was tough. But we did. It was 40 days, 1,208 kilometers. And it was just like my journey through addiction. You know, when you look at overcoming addiction, it seems like a mountain. But if you put one foot in front of the other consistently, and you make the right choices and you move in the right direction, you'll get to the end. So we did it in 40 days, and that was a record.
Again, to just skip through one or two things that deserve mentioning, you want to climb all 7 of the world's highest mountains, right? You've already climbed Kilimanjaro.
Yeah.
You've climbed Kosciuszko.
Yeah.
And Aconcagua.
Yes.
Which is the highest peak in South America.
Yeah.
So what's next?
So next is Elbrus in Russia, Everest, Vincent in Antarctica, and Denali in North America. So those are the 4 that are left. But it's tough. I mean, mountains are expensive, so I got to become a successful individual before I can get to the
big ones. But you are. I mean, in 2010, you were awarded Top Entrepreneur of the Year Award at the 8th Annual African Access National Business Awards. You were included in the Mail and Guardian Top 200 Young South Africans in 2011. You founded Eurocom, which is a mobile marketing company and specialist prize sourcing and fulfillment company. And there is no doubt that you're now a huge success. But do you think that if you could talk to the Marco of 1998... what would you say to him?
Man, that's a difficult one. I'd say to him, if I could look back now, and I probably say this to everyone else that's dealing with this issue and it's in a dark place, is that, you know, just keep fighting, you know, because it's not always going to be like this, you know, that you can change things. And I think that for me is the biggest thing, is that we feel so hopeless when we're in that situation. And, you know, people just need to know, and I needed to know then that, you know, Dory, you just got to keep pushing, because there's light at the end of the tunnel, but you've got to want it. I mean, that's the fact. If you don't want to change, you'll never change. But if you want something bad enough, you can do it.
Do you think Catherine's glad she made the decision to marry you?
I hope so. I mean, I think she
is. What kind of a dad are you, by the way?
I don't know. Sometimes I think I'm a bad dad, but I'd like to consider myself as a good dad. You know, I suppose I love my kids, and yeah, they're good for me.
Well, dude, I love the story. The book is just absolutely phenomenal. It's called Rocks, One Man's Climb from Drugs to Dreams. Marco Brocato, thank you very much for coming to see us this
Thanks
morning.
For having me.
What a story. Sure. If you missed any of that, you can catch it all on the podcast. It will be there for you to download anytime you like. Use the Cliff Central app, or you can go and get it on cliffcentral.com. Our guest this morning, Marco Brocato, thank you very much. Thank you, Mubs. Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Pashita. Thank you, Flax. Thank you, most of all, to you. Here's what you need to know to wrap up your day. The Pokemon Go craze is getting out of control. These little virtual creatures are popping up everywhere, but not everyone is happy to see them. Many cops in America have clashed with them, and fatal shootings are already being recorded. Users of the platform are now starting to spot Pokemon Lives Matter rallies, with many of them turning violent. In other news, Kim Jong-un is feeling very left out that no Pokemons are in North Korea. He would know. He has the only smartphone in the country, and he's creating his own fun by dressing up soldiers as Pokemons and making them run around his palace. And finally, Cristiano Ronaldo and the Portuguese team received a hero's welcome back in Portugal after winning their Euro title. Everything was going great in the parade until Ronaldo was asked to introduce the squad to the adoring fans. Not knowing any of his fellow players' names, he just kept saying, "Pass to me," while the crowd cheered accordingly. All right, we will see you tomorrow between 6 and 9. Cliffcentral.com.